Welcome to VOA Asia Weekend. Over the next 60 minutes, you'll hear some of the top stories and features of the past week from our daily VOA Asia program. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Here's Ira Melman.
In the Indian capital of New Delhi, authorities declared a public health emergency this month as air pollution levels hit hazardous levels, a problem that the city wrestles with in winter months when stagnant winds and cooler temperatures hold the toxic air over the city. Doctors warn that the dirty air is extracting a serious toll on the health of the city's 20 million residents. Palki Sharma is the executive editor and anchor of We on TV, one of the largest English-language TV networks based in New Delhi. She joins us now by telephone. Palki, how bad is the air in your city?
So right now, things are much better, but on Sunday, it was very bad. It was hazy. You could feel it in your eyes. If you stood on top of a building, you could feel that the smog was so thick, you could cut it with a knife into pieces. People did not go out. Playgrounds were empty. Schools had to be shut. It was very bad. It's not an exaggeration when we say that Delhi became a toxic gas chamber.
You had a scathing editorial type piece on one of your broadcasts yesterday on WeOn. Tell us something about what you had to say in that.
Paint a very good picture of India or Delhi when your national capital is breathing this kind of air, and we cannot provide, after 70 years of independence, something as basic as clean air and clean water to our people.
What else can the government do to help the situation?
A lot. The government can do a lot. Another thing that I mentioned in my editorial yesterday was that the government and all the agencies together seem to be guilt-tripping people by saying, do not burn firecrackers on Diwali, do not use private vehicles, but we do not have a very robust public transport system. So the people who have to go to work, the people who have to go to hospitals, the people who have to send their children to school, they have to use something to commute. And the buses and local trains are not enough, not nearly enough, to deal with the load. So people drive cars and people ride bikes. And yes, vehicular traffic contributes to 40% of pollution, and passenger cars make 10% of this emission. So yes, this is a problem. But to solve it, you have to provide alternatives to people. So the government can do that. The government can ensure that they act before things become so bad, because this has become an annual tradition now.
You are raising a family in New Delhi. How has it affected you?
Well, I do not remember a time when every room in your house had air purifiers. We are actively looking for plants to keep in our house. I have two young children, and I'm very worried about the kind of life they're leading in the capital. There are lots of opportunities here, but at the same time, if you're breathing this air, then, you know, one report says that this toxic air is cutting the life expectancy of each individual by 7 years. Another report said that cancer cases are up by 300% in India. 1.5 million people are dying because of pollution-related diseases every year in this country. This is bigger than terrorism. This is bigger than anything that you can inflict on a people. So I'm very worried. There are many complex problems, but there has to be a solution. Artificial rain is one, though the people are divided on that. We can have more trees. We can ensure that the farmers are subsidized and given better alternatives. A lot can be done, but the problem is that most of the political leaders remain in denial. We've had union ministers treating things like eat carrots and broccoli to ensure that you evade the ill effects of pollution. This is how seriously they take this. And I don't know how much action can we expect.
Palki Sharma is the executive editor and anchor of We on TV, one of the largest English-language TV networks based in New Delhi. We invite you to read more on our top story by following us on Facebook, VOA Asia, and the voanews.com website. U.S. President Donald Trump sent a low-ranking delegation to important summits with Southeast Asian leaders this past week, triggering concerns about Washington's commitment to the region as a strategic partner. White House correspondent Patsy Whitakasora has the story.
On the world stage, showing up matters. At this week's East Asia and ASEAN summits, President Trump did not attend, nor did he send his vice president or secretary of state. Adhering to diplomatic protocol, Southeast Asian leaders did not show up for the U.S.-ASEAN meeting either. Sending their foreign ministers to meet National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien, Trump's special envoy for the summits.
As he said in his letter, President Trump wants to assure you of the rock-solid American commitment in word and deed to our friends, allies, and partners in ASEAN.
O'Brien extended Trump's invitation to Southeast Asian leaders to a summit in the U.S. early next year. Brian Harding is the Southeast Asia Program Fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
I'm sure they'll take the invitation seriously. There is an interest in the United States being more deeply engaged for making a joint trip to the United States.
Until then, critics say Washington's viewpoint is missing on regional negotiations, including on free trade, where China is dominating. A new economic agreement initiated by Beijing is underway at the summit. The Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, or RCEP, is expected to launch next year. It will account for a third of global gross domestic product and nearly half the world's population. Lei Yucheng is the Chinese vice foreign minister.
It definitely will play a crucial role in promoting regional economic integration and cooperation across the board, especially on trade and investment.
Another multilateral deal, the Comprehensive and Progressive Agreement for Trans-Pacific Partnership, is also moving along without Washington. The Trump administration prefers bilateral trade agreements, but has not yet struck any in the region. Brian Harding of CSIS.
Japan has really slow-walked the bilateral trade negotiations as much as they can. Vietnam, who seemed to be a possibility, is just not interested. The Philippines is not interested. They look at how the United States has treated its closest allies and partners, Canada, Mexico, Europe, Korea, and they don't want anything to do with it.
Meanwhile, the trade war between the U.S. and China continues to worry ASEAN leaders. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News, White House.
Coming your way, a massacre of government forces in Thailand. This is VOA Asia.
VOA Asia Facebook is the choice of millions to see and read the latest stories about Asia and the United States. Follow us on VOA Asia Facebook. VOA Asia is also on Twitter and YouTube. Subscribe to all of our platforms for free. See, hear, read, and share all the latest from VOA Asia anytime. VOA Asia is your trusted source for news, information, and great features. With many of the top stories from the past week, we continue with VOA Asia Weekend.
November 8th marks the third anniversary of Donald Trump's 2016 election as the 45th president of the United States. Trump remains a force of nature in American politics, but the third anniversary of his rise to power comes at a time when he's facing the gravest threat yet to his presidency. An impeachment inquiry led by congressional Democrats over his efforts to pressure Ukraine to investigate political rival Joe Biden. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone has more from Washington.
3 years have passed since that November night when Donald Trump shocked the world with his election as the nation's 45th president.
To all Republicans and Democrats and independents across this nation, I say it is time for us to come together as one united people.
That early appeal for unity faded long ago.
But the more America achieves, the more hateful and enraged these crazy Democrats become.
Trump is now counting on his loyal base of supporters to first withstand impeachment and then carry him to re-election next year.
At stake in this fight is the survival of American democracy itself. Don't kid yourself. That's what they want. They are destroying this country, but we will never let it happen, not even close.
The impeachment probe in the House is focused on Trump's alleged efforts to pressure Ukraine to investigate political rival Joe Biden. Biden has made Trump the issue in his bid to win the Democratic Party's presidential nomination next year.
He talks about there will be a civil war. This is the guy that's unhinged. He is unhinged. I worry about what he's going to do, not about me or my family. I worry about what he'll do in the next year in the presidency.
Like so much in Trump's presidency, the impeachment inquiry is playing out along party lines, says analyst John Fortier.
For Democrats, they believe the president has done something wrong, and they think they're going to bring out more evidence. And I think their hope is that that will turn public opinion against the president, perhaps allow him to be removed. Republicans, I think, are looking at past precedent to say this could be something that backfires on Democrats, or at least doesn't catch fire.
Polls show Trump's approval rating at just above 40%, historically weak for an incumbent president trying to fight off impeachment and seeking re-election at the same time. But underestimating Trump's hold on his political base is dangerous, says Republican strategist John Fiery.
Are the Washington pundits, is everyone inside the Beltway missing it about Trump? Absolutely. They don't have any clue this guy's real appeal at a visceral level. But one of the reasons why they support him is because he keeps his promises and he's got the economy going.
Even if Trump is eventually impeached by the democratically controlled House, he would likely survive an impeachment trial in the Republican-controlled Senate, says analyst William Galston.
I have believed since the very beginning of impeachment talk, which started up more than a year ago, that if the Democrats are to remove President Trump from office, it will have to be through the electoral process in 2020. Nothing that I've seen so far inclines me to change my mind in the slightest.
3 years into the tumultuous presidency of Donald Trump, Americans are now girding themselves for the prospect of both a partisan battle over impeachment and perhaps the most fiercely contested election in recent memory. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
Gunmen in insurgency wrecked southern Thailand killed 15 village defense volunteers and wounded 5 security personnel in what is believed to be the deadliest attack on government forces since the separatist rebellion began 15 years ago. VOA's Jeff Custer has more.
A Thai army spokesman said bloodstained clothing found at the scene suggested that some of the attackers on 2 checkpoints in Yala province late Tuesday night also may have been wounded in the exchanges of gunfire. The spokesman added 4 of the slain officers were women and 1 was a doctor. A senior police official described what appeared to be a coordinated attack. Nails were scattered on a highway to disable vehicles entering Yala. A small explosive device was found near an electrical pole to knock out power, and several burning tires were left at a school. Thailand's volunteer forces in the south are recruited from villages and receive weapons training from the army, but no salary. They are usually issued shotguns, but often carry personal handguns and only guard their own villages rather than seek to confront the insurgents. Over 7,000 people have been killed since the insurgency erupted in 2004 in Thailand's 3 southernmost provinces, the only ones with Muslim majorities in the Buddhist-dominated country. Muslim residents have long charged that they are treated like second-class citizens, and separatist movements have been periodically active for decades. Heavy-handed crackdowns have fueled the discontent. Jeff Custer, VOA News.
A bakery located in a suburb of Long Island, New York, is being held as a symbol of interfaith harmony by the local population and the media. VOA's Anshuman Optave visited the bakery and spoke to its Pakistani-American owner to find out why people of different faiths are attracted to it.
When the previous owner of Beach Bakery Grand Cafe decided to sell it a few years ago, the news concerned residents of West Hampton Beach, home to area's large Jewish population. After all, the bakery had been serving their dietary needs for almost 3 decades.
Since my family is kosher, we appreciated that because there's no other kosher place in the area.
The Jewish community was concerned if the new owner would keep kosher or abide by Jewish dietary restrictions. But Rashid Suleri, who bought Beach Bakery Grand Cafe in 2018, met with community members and assured them he would do just that.
Given 10-minute speech, I gave a speech in the local synagogue. About 800 of their members listened to what I had to say. It was also being broadcast live to almost 4.1 million other viewers. We have their certificate, and anybody can come and see if we are kosher or not.
While Rashid kept the bakery kosher by adhering to kashrut, the Jewish dietary laws, he also ensured that the food preparation met the halal standards as per his own Muslim faith.
Kosher or halal?
The main difference between kosher and halal food comes from the way meat is handled and prepared. So we decided to get rid of meat from our menu. So when you are not serving meat, the dairy and vegetarian products, if they meet the kosher requirement, they are automatically halal. The other challenging thing was the alcoholic drinks. So we decided to get rid of them too.
After the changes, along with its large Jewish customer base, the area's Muslim community started visiting the bakery in large numbers.
When my kids heard about this place, we felt that we should all pay a visit.
Most of the stuff that's here, you can't find it in a lot of the places.
It shows the open-mindedness of this community.
They meet each other and have conversations. They try to understand each other. And that's why the bakery is well-regarded in this community.
With its kosher and halal food, the Beach Bakery Grand Cafe has become an example of religious integration in the West Hampton Beach area. But for owner Rashid Suleri, like any other popular eatery, the mouth-watering food is the best reason to visit his cafe. Aushman Apte, VOA News.
Imagine being paralyzed by a stroke for years. Some researchers at the University of Southern California's Keck School of Medicine are trying to help in ways that traditional physical therapy cannot, by connecting the brain to the computer and using virtual reality. VOA's Elizabeth Lee has more from Los Angeles.
David Karchem remembers exactly when his life changed forever.
It was actually 10 years, 3 months, and 3 days ago.
That's when Karchem experienced a stroke while driving. He was able to pull over and get help, but the left side of his body was paralyzed. While traditional physical therapy helped a little initially, brain-computer interface and virtual reality are helping him regain movement more than 10 years after his stroke.
If somebody can't move their arm in the real world, we can augment that in the virtual world and take their body's attempt to move and make it seem like they're moving in the virtual world.
Occupational therapist and neuroscientist Sukli Liu says when someone has a stroke, there is a blockage in the brain that cuts off blood flow. But virtual reality through brain-computer interface may help encourage the brain to find new routes and bypass the blockage. In this study, electrodes are placed on the scalp and on the arm muscles. They're connected to the computer and this virtual world. The user has to try to move this virtual arm with their real arm or with their mind.
We hope that showing them a virtual arm that moves, that maybe they can feel like is a little bit of their own body, that helps to reinforce and kind of reward the motor attempt. And then it should strengthen the brain activity related to controlling motor abilities.
Karchem says working with a virtual arm has helped him extend his arm and move his wrist and fingers.
It's improved my walking ability.
But Karchem says the positive effects of a session like this only last for a few months. Researchers are working on a more portable version of this technology for participants to take home and continue studying how brain-computer interface and VR can help stroke patients gain a better quality of life. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Los Angeles.
With Ira Melman, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Stay with us. There's more VOA Asia Weekend coming up.
After you listen to VOA Asia, you can see VOA Asia. VOA Asia is on YouTube. See and share the fun with Food Bites, our weekly culinary dive into foods from the homeland. Recipes that came with chefs who immigrated to the United States. Students enrolling in U.S. schools can get their first lessons about life on campus. Subscribe for free. See us often at VOA Asia YouTube.
This is VOA Asia Weekend. A U.S. Senate subcommittee opening hearings Tuesday examining the tech industry's possible ties to China was without anyone from Apple and from the Chinese-owned social media app TikTok, both refusing to send a representative to Washington's hearing. The subcommittee is chaired by Senator Josh Hawley, who opened the hearing facing two empty chairs with Apple and TikTok name cards placed on a desk in front of the chairs. Hawley's opening statement was aimed first at TikTok.
The threat isn't just to children's privacy. It's a threat to our national security. We don't know what China can do with this kind of social data in aggregate, what it tells China about our society. They can see who we talk to, what we talk about, where we congregate, what we capture on video. Not all of TikTok's users are just kids. Some work in government or for the military. Others are celebrities or work for major American companies in positions of influence. What does it mean for China to have a window into such users' social lives? Why would we leave that window open?
Hawley then turned to Apple's relationship with Beijing.
China is essential to Apple's bottom line, both on the supply and the demand sides of their business. Apple's investments in Chinese production have helped build the scientific and manufacturing capacity of America's greatest geopolitical rival. But Chinese demand is even more critical to Apple's future. And to service that demand, Apple is risking compromise with authoritarianism.
Apple said it had no comment on its decision not to send a representative to the hearing. TikTok said it was not able to send a suitable delegate on short notice, but was committed to working productively with Congress. If you're not familiar with TikTok, the video app has become the world's most downloaded app. Teenagers are fueling the craze by posting videos as short as 15 seconds of themselves, dancing, lip-syncing, being silly, and generally showing off. Michelle Quinn talked to teenagers about why TikTok is important to them.
For teenagers, the app TikTok is a way to have fun.
I think some of the videos that people make are really funny, and it's a good way to make videos online, and it's a good way to like connect with some people.
They see me rolling, they hating, patrolling and trying to catch me riding.
TikTok users make short videos, 15 to 60 seconds long, of themselves lip-syncing, showing off, dancing. They post the video to their followers.
And then I was like, I'm tired of just watching. I'm trying to make some so I can actually go viral. So what you do is you scroll through a TikTok and you see a sound that you like, right?
Users find a sound. It could be a song, a sentence, or another person's TikTok. Every day, TikTok's algorithm offers more than 1 billion users new videos to watch.
I usually do memes or dance ones, basically, because those are the fun ones. And they take forever to learn, but like it's fun once you get it. I had a bunch of friends doing this. It's funny, especially when it's a tiny group of people and you get to connect with the audio and stuff like that. It's fun to make.
And it's addictive.
The thing about TikTok is you're like, oh, I'll just go on TikTok for a few minutes, and you go on and then you get like you're scrolling and you just end up scrolling for hours and hours and hours.
These students say TikTok has given them a new way to entertain and be entertained. Michelle Quinn, VOA News, Oakland, California.
As TikTok faces investigation by the U.S. government over potential national security concerns, the democracy watchdog group Freedom House released a report Tuesday painting a bleak outlook for the way that many governments are using social media. The Freedom House report says governments spy on us while others seek to manipulate elections. VOA's Arash Arabasadi spoke with one of the authors of the report and has this story.
According to a new report by the Washington-based nonprofit Freedom House, social media liberties are trending down.
Our two main themes this year were looking at how governments are using social media to undermine their own elections and also monitor their citizens.
Freedom House analyst Ali Funk co-authored Freedom on the Net 2019. The report says 40 of 65 countries with internet freedom have advanced social media surveillance programs.
We found that domestic actors, whether that be government or politicians that are seeking to be elected, actually use the internet to undermine a fair and free election in their country. And the most common tactic that they use was the spread of political propaganda and disinformation.
The most often used tool was the spread of disinformation, mostly by far-right politicians. Funk says the power of social media emerged in the Arab Spring.
I don't know if everybody realized how quickly this was going to be turned, how governments were going to use this against us. Governments have figured out, like, oh, wait, we can actually use the internet against our own citizens.
Fire! Fire! Government attempts to curb internet freedoms can backfire. as was the case in Moscow this summer after the Kremlin stymied opposition political candidates. Anti-government protesters used social media to organize.
The protesters there were acutely aware that the government was probably watching or surveilling. So they started using code words for different protest movements, and they started to organize on these platforms as well to get administrative aid to somebody who was maybe arrested or to get food or other water to protesters.
This is the 10th time a Freedom of the Net study has been published since 2009. The reports find that internet freedoms dropped annually for each of those years. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News, Washington.
We continue now with VOA Asia Weekend. India has become one of the world's top three countries with the worst air quality, and its capital is the world's most polluted city. According to the World Air Quality Project, the air quality index above 150 is considered unhealthy, but the levels in New Delhi have been well above 300, the highest indicator for hazardous air quality. In an effort to reduce the dangerous levels, authorities have restricted vehicle use in the city. VOA's Slotika Hoke has more.
New Delhi and the surrounding area saw record-breaking air pollution over the weekend. The city's government has declared a public health emergency and imposed restrictions on the use of vehicles. Until November 15th, cars with odd numbers on their tags drive one day and cars with even numbers the next day. People who tried to drive into Delhi on Monday with registration tags ending in an odd number were stopped.
I did not know that the odd-even rule was starting from today. I came to Delhi for some work last night, and I was returning home. When I saw the signs, I tried to escape quickly, but I was caught. I won't make the same mistake again.
Flights have been delayed or cancelled at Delhi's Indira Gandhi International Airport, and authorities have also shut area schools and ordered all construction work to stop in an effort to slash pollution.
Here at the airport, we are facing difficulty breathing. There's a burning sensation as if someone had put chili pepper in my eyes.
Health officials warn that everyone is at risk of serious health effects. People venturing into the streets donned breathing masks, as residents of Chinese capital Beijing used to have to do. A tourist from China visiting India's mausoleum Taj Mahal, more than 300 kilometers south of New Delhi, encountered a hazy sight.
We landed here on Friday, and it was pretty bad. It was hard to look outside. We see that it's swinging a lot. So last night, we stayed in Delhi. Last night, it was actually pretty good, and we could see very far. But then again, this morning, it was pretty bad again.
20 years ago, China's capital, Beijing, was one of the world's most polluted cities due to widespread coal combustion and motor vehicle traffic. But then the government adopted systematic and intensive measures to improve the air quality. Today, residents of Beijing and other big Chinese cities can walk out without breathing masks, and there are plans for continued improvements. Much of the reduction in pollutants came from measures to control coal-fired boilers, provide cleaner domestic fuels, and industrial restructuring. Zlatica Hoek, VOA News, Washington.
There's more VOA Asia Weekend coming up.
If you doubt the speed at which the world is changing, just take a look at the digital media. In the last 20 years, the introduction of mobile and internet technology has spawned breathtaking advances in the sharing of information and commerce. Today, an estimated one quarter of the Earth's population uses the services of the internet. Two-thirds of us now own a mobile phone. But these advances into the digital age have been met with problems. Problems like state censorship, hackers, and identity theft, to name just a few. The Voice of America wants to know how the digital world has transformed your life. Or have they? We'd like you to tell us your story by writing or sending videos to our website, Twitter, or Facebook page. Find out more by visiting us at our webpage at voanews.com and then click on Digital Frontier. Tell your story and share it with the world through VOA's Digital Frontier.
With many of the top stories from the past week, we continue with VOA Asia Weekend. Dozens of women in Bamyan province of Afghanistan recently received their driver's licenses after taking driving tests monitored by local traffic police. VOA's Afar Bamyani has this report, narrated by Bejan Hamdard.
Central Afghanistan's Bamyan province is widely known for its two large historic Buddha statues destroyed by the Taliban in 2001. Since then, the Taliban has been ousted and Bamyan has become one of the country's safest provinces. With security in place, locals are now enjoying freedom and development. For the first time in Bamyan, a group of 58 women have received their driver's licenses after completing an 8-week training program.
I'm very happy. Driving a car is important. Every individual should learn this skill and use their legal rights.
Our society is traditional. Maybe they do not welcome well, but fortunately here in Bamyan, there is less challenge.
In a conservative country like Afghanistan, religious scholars are highly respected. And while most scholars oppose women taking part in music, driving seems to be accepted.
There is no probation for women to drive a car as long as they observe Islamic hijab.
There are roughly 100 women driving in Bamyan. Many say while they do turn heads, they see a better future ahead.
I feel proud when I drive. I am glad I have this opportunity to drive as a woman.
It's a good thing that women are driving. It shows improvement and progress. In other countries, women are pilots or doctors. I have no problem with women driving. I think they are really good drivers. They drive with a lot of patience.
Instructors say women are eager to learn.
This group of women we have been training since the beginning of the year are the most intelligent and most interested of all the ones.
Bamyan's traffic police expect the number of women taking part in driving courses to increase significantly in the upcoming year. For Zafar Bamyani in Bamyan, Afghanistan, Bejan Hamdard, VOA News.
As VOA Asia continues, helping to prop up Hong Kong tourism and Thailand's tourists hit by the trade war are the topics on today's VOA Asia Business Scene with Ira Melman.
Hong Kong's government is worried about its vital tourism industry after 5 months of protest, but tourists expressed their optimism about visiting the besieged city.
I was surprised at the hotel prices, so that was good. It was quite a positive, and the flights too.
Tourist numbers to the metropolis began to drop in July by about 5% year on year. In August, it plunged by nearly 40%. Ronald Wu is chairman of the Hong Kong Association of Travel Agents.
With such a dramatic drop, it's definitely a very difficult time for not only the tourism industry, but also for the retail, the hotels, and pretty much I would say the entire Hong Kong is currently going through a very, very difficult time.
The government announced $12 million U.S. dollars in subsidies to travel agencies and relevant industries such as hotels, airlines, and retail, all of which have lost business since the unrest broke out in June. The plan is expected to start in November and run until March of next year. The subsidies are given to travel agencies rather than tourists, so some are wondering how this plan can encourage more tourists to visit Hong Kong. Many, like this tour guide, agree that the key to reviving Hong Kong's tourism is not money, but the restoration of peace and order as soon as possible. Hotels on Thailand's most popular holiday island have been forced to slash prices, with rooms left vacant and beaches sparse as tourists struggle with a plunge in Chinese visitors caused by the U.S. trade war and a stronger baht. Known for its beaches and nightlife, sun-drenched Phuket was the most visited destination in the country last year after Bangkok, and a good gauge of the state of its crucial travel industry. Tourism accounts for 18% of Thailand's gross domestic product, and Chinese holidaymakers make up more than a quarter of the total arrivals. But while 2.2 million people from the country visited in 2018, numbers for January through September were down almost a fifth on the year. The problem is not just in Phuket. Seaside resorts of Pattaya and the mainland and Koh Samui Island are also struggling to fill rooms. Trade tensions with the U.S. have already made some Chinese reluctant to take holidays owing to uncertainty back home, while the Thai baht has risen about 10% against the yuan this year. New hoteliers and tour package operators are targeting visitors from elsewhere, particularly India, which experts see as a huge untapped market. For VOA Business Scene, I'm Ira Melman.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English. Now on VOA Asia, in October, California became the first U.S. state to ban sales of animal fur products. The decision made animal lovers happy, but it's not selling well with stores that sell fur. Angela Bagsarian has the story, narrated by Anna Rice.
Evner Hayat's great-grandfather opened his first fur store in Russia before immigrating to the United States. Back then, he says fur was special because only the very rich could afford it. These days, it's just as rare, but for a different reason.
My customers for the last year and a half already have been very confused about the ban. Can we wear fur? Can we not wear fur? Is it okay? Is somebody going to throw something on us? Is it we're going to go to jail, some people tell me.
The reason for the confusion, a series of laws signed by California Governor Gavin Newsom that, among other things, banned sales of new clothing and accessories made of fur. The cruelty of the whole process is what prompted lawmakers to go ahead with the new law. Prohibiting killing animals for their fur means killing the fur business, says Hayat. And that, in turn, will leave many people unemployed.
The freedom of choice. Tomorrow somebody is going to come and tell you that you cannot eat hamburgers anymore. I want to see what people will do that own McDonald's and Burger Kings and everything, because they kill animals for food a million times more than what it's used for furs. We're not a very strong industry.
Yelena Makarova Ali, co-owner of a Los Angeles showroom, believes the fight is already lost. So she decided to bring four fur coats and jackets from Italy. On top of that, she believes it makes little sense to wear fur coats in the state where the climate is so mild and so warm.
We tried buying a few natural fur coats in Italy and bringing them here, but to my surprise, no one seems to be interested.
The law will come into force in 2023, and it is likely New York State will follow suit. Those who work in the natural fur industry hope to bring the matter to court, accusing California authorities of discrimination. For Angelina Magdasarian in Los Angeles, NRI's VOA News.
In the age of technology, walking to get around doesn't have to slow you down. As consumers, we've got plenty of options. We can call taxi-like services such as Uber or Lyft, rent a bicycle by just using our phones. But the most recent form of transportation is taking cities across the globe by storm. VOA's Sadia Sebranhal informs us about the pros and cons of scootering around Washington, D.C.
Powered by a battery, electric scooters or e-scooters can be seen zipping around the streets of Washington, D.C. For tourists coming to the U.S. Capitol, these colorful scooters have become the latest attraction.
Yeah, it's super fun.
Because they're great fun.
Because it's really fun and it's a lot quicker than walking.
They have quickly become an option for people who aren't going far enough to justify a taxi but don't want to wait for a bus or walk.
We're just really trying to provide options to the district residents, to our visitors, low-cost options. And scooters is just another low-cost option that allows people to be able to traverse throughout the city. And it seems to be a very economical route, as well as good for the environment as well.
But not everyone is on board. The growing number of scooters taking over sidewalks bothers many. D.C. City Council member Mary Chay has introduced a bill to ban scooters from 10 p.m. to 4 a.m. to reduce accidents in the dark. But officials from one scooter company disagree with the late-night ban and insist the scooters are perfectly safe if riders follow the rules.
In our app, when you open up our app, it says very simply, not to ride on the sidewalk, ride in a bike lane when a bike lane arises. And also we do a thing called geofencing, which is in the app there's a map and it says where you can and cannot go, basically.
Though we don't see many riders actually using helmets.
The problem is nobody wears a helmet.
Doesn't really fit in my backpack.
There are 8 different companies offering e-scooter services in Washington, D.C. with thousands of daily users. Everett Lott says these scooters do not pose a safety risk.
We've had about 150 incidents reported during about an 8-month time span. And again, less than 25% of those were happening during the evening times. But in terms of specific types of injuries, I haven't seen any data to reflect that.
Some scooter companies offer training for first-time riders. But as with the helmet, there haven't been many takers. Sadia Zebranja, VOA News, Washington.
71 medical institutions, including some of the most prestigious medical schools in the United States, are now investigating 180 cases involving potential theft of intellectual properties. The New York Times on Monday reported that almost all of the people under investigation are of Chinese descent. VOA Asia's Ira Melman got in touch with Dr. Ross McKinney, Chief Scientific Officer of the Association of American Medical Colleges.
Well, it sounds like a lot of people, but when you actually then think about the number of Chinese researchers or researchers of Southeast Asian descent in the United States at our schools of medicine and who are funded by the NIH, there are about 6,000 funded investigators of Asian background that the NIH funds. So the 180 sounds like a lot, but in fact, it's a pretty small proportion of the overall population of Chinese scientists or scientists of Asian descent.
Is it worrisome?
It is worrisome, and what makes it worrisome is because the collaboration between the U.S. and citizens from China who have come to work in our laboratories, who have come to work with our universities, who become collaborators, has been a really strong and rich one. And so when you start to break down the trust, it may make that very rich and very powerful collaboration more of a problem. And that's sad. I mean, we really don't want to see that because of how important these collaborations have been.
Does this threaten all of this? Does this threaten this open exchange of medical information between the U.S. and China?
It raises concerns because there are certain ground rules you expect people in science to follow. You expect people to respect that somebody who has an idea will get to develop their own idea. And once it's developed enough, you can publish it.
How was all this discovered?
It was discovered originally, as best I can tell, at MD Anderson, which is a cancer center in Texas. And they had a case where somebody was sending things to China, PDFs of grant applications, and then started to pursue and discovered that there was a program in China called the Thousand Talents Program that was recruiting scientists. And when the scientists chose not to be recruited to China, was instead funding them to do work in China while remaining on faculty in the U.S. And so that's where the problem began and from where it was uncovered.
Is the U.S. government involved in these investigations?
The U.S. and government is at the core of these investigations. While institutions are asked to do an evaluation, the FBI is engaged and the NIH is involved and is aware of or prompted most of those 180 investigations.
There are those, as you know, who are warning that these Chinese and Chinese-American academics are now feeling at risk, including, of course, those who are not part of this situation, mm-hmm. and this crackdown will stop or stem the flow of researchers from China to the United States. Others are going as far as saying that it's racist. How do you react to that?
I think that it has had a chilling effect, and it is very sad because the issue has not been with the Chinese people. The issue has been with the Chinese government, which was doing this in a systematic way. There are a very high proportion of graduate students in the U.S. in the biomedical sciences who are Chinese by background or citizenship. A lot of our postdocs, people who are continuing to learn new techniques and develop new tools after finishing their PhD, are also of Chinese national descent. And it's been a very rich collaboration. This, unfortunately, makes people suspicious and will make it less appealing to come to the U.S. And that's particularly sad because of how beneficial this relationship has been for decades.
Dr. Ross McKinney, Chief Scientific Officer of the Association of American Medical Colleges. He was speaking with VOA Asia's Ira Melman. Coming up, moves to remove the U.S. president. This is VOA Asia Weekend.
VOA Asia is on Twitter. Follow us at VOA Asia for developing stories in Asia, perhaps close to you. Our Twitter feed also has updates on programs you can hear and see, with links to easily find them. VOA Asia Twitter, we're always online for you.
It's the end of another week. Sit back and relax as we continue with more VOA Asia Weekend. A new report finds sanctions imposed on North Korea are failing to advance denuclearization prospects on the Korean Peninsula, while causing immense suffering to the civilian population. An international multidisciplinary panel of independent experts compiled the report. The report is the first comprehensive assessment of the human impact of sanctions against North Korea. Lisa Schlein has more for VOA from Geneva.
The United Nations strengthened economic sanctions against North Korea in 2016 with the aim of bringing Pyongyang to the nuclear negotiating table with Washington. This tactic, however, has not worked. The talks remain deadlocked. While targeted sanctions against North Korea's elite are ineffective, authors of the report say evidence shows they are having a devastating impact on the general population, especially women and children. They say sanctions are adversely affecting humanitarian aid and economic development in the country. They cite UN agencies that report 40% of North Korea's population is going hungry and in desperate need of assistance. 6 out of 10 people do not have access to safe drinking water, and malnutrition among children is increasing. Christine Ahn is founder of Women Cross DMZ, a global movement of women to end the Korean War. She says the sanctions are barring the import of essential items, including medical equipment, agricultural material essential for food production, and components for water and sanitation programs. She says authors of the report warn the lack of these goods threaten the lives of the most vulnerable people in North Korea.
They assess that nearly 4,000 people died in 2018 as a result of the delays caused by the sanctions of materials and aid coming into North Korea, as well as the funding shortfalls.
Last year, UN agencies were able to raise only 21% of the $111 million they needed for urgent humanitarian programs, leaving a funding gap of $87 million. No progress has been made in nuclear negotiations since U.S. President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un held a historic first face-to-face meeting in Singapore last year and signed a declaration promising to transform their relations. Ahn tells VOA the U.S. could advance this goal by partially lifting the sanctions that are hurting the civilian population.
This is something that the United States can do. It wouldn't do anything to cost anything to U.S. taxpayers, and I think it would go a long way to improving the basic security of North Korean people, and it could be a very concrete step towards advancing the step-by-step approach that ultimately will lead to denuclearization and a peace agreement.
Trump and Kim met a second time earlier this year in Hanoi, Vietnam. Those talks, however, ended with no agreement. Ahn says it would be wise to involve women in the U.S.-North Korea nuclear talks. She says research shows when women are engaged in a peace process, their participation actually leads to a peace agreement and one that is more likely to be durable. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
We're glad you're with us today on VOA Asia. The United Nations General Assembly recently marked World Cities Day. This year's theme focused on innovations and better life for future generations. Part of that involves ranking cities on their livability. VOA's Arash Arabasadi looks at why one of the world's most populous cities, Karachi, Pakistan, ranks near the bottom.
Karachi is Pakistan's financial and industrial nerve center, but experts say it suffers from chronic underinvestment in city services.
The infrastructure that people commonly use for transportation,
for access to drinking water, for the proper functioning of a sewerage system, for disposal of solid waste. Those services were obviously not attended. And this situation has continued on for quite a sizable period of time.
To be sure, parts of Karachi are undergoing upgrades. But the city's mayor says much of Karachi's infrastructure needs more upkeep than the city alone can provide.
Karachi ko total revamping chahiye.
No doubt the responsibility lies with government, but the federal government should give special attention to a city with two major ports. Imagine a city like Karachi, mishandled by provincial and federal governments. They went for short-term solutions, but we need a complete revamp of the system.
Once known as the City of Lights, Karachi now holds a far more dubious distinction. It is near the bottom of the Economist Intelligence Unit's annual ranking of cities, which accounts for things like infrastructure, healthcare, and environmental conditions. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News, Washington.
The U.S. Congress made history last week with a vote formally approving a formal impeachment inquiry of President Donald Trump. Trump has now become the fourth U.S. president to become the subject of an impeachment investigation based on his alleged efforts to pressure Ukraine to investigate political rival Joe Biden. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone has more on what the congressional vote means and what to expect next from Washington.
Those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say no.
High drama and history as the Congress moved forward on impeachment, led by the Democratic Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi.
This is something that is very solemn, that is something prayerful.
Pelosi and many Democrats believe President Trump abused his power by pressuring Ukraine to investigate one of his political rivals, former Vice President Joe Biden.
We take an oath to protect and defend the Constitution, and that's what we cannot ignore, and we will not ignore when the president's behavior indicates that that investigation, that inquiry is necessary.
House Republicans are unified against impeachment, and Republican leader Kevin McCarthy says Democrats are trying to undo Trump's victory in the 2016 election.
Democrats are trying to impeach the president because they are scared they cannot defeat him at the ballot box. That's not my words. That's the words of my colleagues from the other side of the aisle that has offered impeachment three different times.
The president blasted the impeachment vote on Twitter as a witch hunt and has long vowed to survive any effort to remove him from office.
I've had the Mueller witch hunt, the Russia witch hunt. I have witch hunts every week. I say, what's the witch hunt this week? They can't beat us at the ballot box. They cannot beat us at the ballot box. So they want to try and beat us the old-fashioned way, which is not very nice. They are a nasty group of people.
The resolution.
This latest House vote is about the process of impeachment going forward, says Julie Pace.
This is about the rules that will govern what happens next in terms of public testimony, in terms of what the public does learn about things that happen behind closed doors.
But the vote launched an important new chapter in the impeachment inquiry, says analyst John Hudak.
Part of the reason for doing this is to transition the process to the next stage, which will be a more public stage. But it will also hold Republicans' feet to the fire to disallow them from making process arguments against the inquiry.
It's a process that could drag on for some time, says John Fortier.
In the House of Representatives, probably going to take a couple of months. We're really at the beginning of that period today. If there's a Senate trial, and the Senate Majority Leader said there will be if there's impeachment, that's likely to take another month or two as well. So this could go on for quite a while into next year.
A House vote to impeach the president would be the equivalent of an indictment or accusation of wrongdoing. That would lead to a Senate trial, where senators would decide whether to remove him from office. Public hearings on the impeachment inquiry are expected to begin later this month. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
You're listening to VOA Asia Weekend. There's much more right after this.
VOA Asia Facebook is the choice of millions to see and read the latest stories about Asia and the United States. Follow us on VOA Asia Facebook and say hello online or on your smartphone. Subscribe to all of our platforms for free. See, hear, and read and share all of the latest from VOA Asia anytime.
VOA Asia is your trusted source for news and great features.
We continue with more VOA Asia Weekend. Great art can change the world. It can show us a moment in time. It can even help us heal profound pain and suffering. That's how one Cambodian dancer is using it. Through dance, she's telling the story of forced marriage during the Khmer Rouge regime. VOA's Chetra Chap reports.
In this performance, a woman begs a Khmer Rouge soldier not to force her into marriage. During the brutal regime, refusing to marry was a treasonous act. Cambodian award-winning dancers and choreographer Sopilin Chiam Shapiro performed the stories of the Khmer Rouge use of forced marriage at a Buddhism-focused event in Washington, D.C. Her hope is to help victims.
The victims of forced marriages can heal watching this performance because their story is heard and remembered.
The 52-year-old choreographer who co-founded Khmer Arts said this dance was born in the courtroom at the Khmer Rouge Tribunal in Cambodia.
They prosecuted the Khmer Rouge leaders in K002/02 for forced marriages during the Pol Pot regime. At the end of the trials, they needed to have a reparation ceremony for the victims, so they asked me to create this dance piece.
The tribunal, officially known as the Extraordinary Chambers in the Courts of Cambodia, was established in 2006. Its purpose was to try the senior Khmer Rouge members most responsible for the 1.7 million lives executed by the regime in the 1970s. In the case of marriage regulation, the regime was found to have forced, quote, the productions of children, unquote, in order to increase the country's population.
And they forced young men and young women to get married.
A Khmer Rouge survivor, Shapiro paints the pictures of the atrocity through her famed innovative approach of infusing traditional dance moves with modern ideas and energy.
She's deeply trained in Cambodian classical dance, and her company performs the classical works, but she's also an innovative choreographer who really pushes Cambodian dance into the present and into the future.
This means Shapiro doesn't just teach her students the dance moves, she helps them find their own creative and independent voices as artists.
Learning this piece, I had to really think about what a Khmer Rouge soldier would feel. Like, why would they be angry and have to put myself in their perspective? Encouraged me and pushed me to have that anger, have that character.
Shapiro and her dancers never experienced the Khmer Rouge forced marriage firsthand. She said they had to be creative in trying to understand what happened and recreate the experience in the form of dancing.
I'm happy that we are using our creativity with a strong foundation in our culture to create something new to represent the creativity of the Cambodian people in the 21st century.
A new way to represent old pain and promote healing. I'm Chatra Chap for VOA News, Washington.
This has been VOA Asia Weekend, a compilation of some of the stories presented throughout the past week on our daily VOA Asia program. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Check out VOA Asia online at voanews.com.